Chapter 9. End of the Line. Lucy awoke the next morning in the position she'd fallen asleep in, wrapped up in Dan's arms. His chin rested on her head as she used his torso as a pillow. San Francisco seemed a distant memory as the train snaked its way through the lunar landscape of the Rocky Mountains. But the boulder-strewn expanse was being invaded by a new color. Covering the dark, rusty landscape were patches of the palest blue. Some sort of glistening moss or lichen was spreading across the region. Lucy felt a wave of nausea and guilt as the station scenes flashed back, and she pressed her head further into Dan's chest, forcing her eyes shut. She couldn't deal with it. Not now. Maybe not ever. Over the course of the day, the train climbed the Jurassic hillscape, at times ascending into the cloud line where the sun's light was scattered and reflected from either side of the carriage in a cold, bright, halogen shade of white, the bottom of the mountains disappearing off into the mist below. Lucy's nose caught the scent of someone else's meal from a few seats ahead. As she walked to the luggage rack at the far end, she noticed that other people were charging their phones and laptops using the train's sockets. She rifled through her and Dan's backpacks, extracting their phones, chargers, and some food. "For you," she said, returning to her seat and placing a tin of fruit in front of her partner. Like her, he hadn't eaten since they'd boarded yesterday. Dan nodded passively, his gaze fixed on the outside. Lucy opened his tin of peaches and left it in front of him with a fork before attending to her own portion. He silently ate before retreating into sleep again. Lucy cleared away and put the phones on to charge. Several more hours passed, during which Lucy contemplated their arrival in D.C., hopeful that Dan's reunion with his father would help him with the loss of his sister Kim. But Lucy herself was still reeling from the loss of Cassie. With no one to talk to, the other passengers were largely silent, she retrieved a notepad and pen from her luggage and began to write. Barring a few particularly pubescent weeks as an early teen, she'd never regarded diary keeping as a worthwhile pursuit. But now it seemed appropriate, important even, to document all that she could remember from the last 2 weeks. What had happened, who they'd seen, what they'd done. She tried to be as objective as possible, aware that it might one day form part of a historical record. And so she penned it all, beginning with Cassie's birthday drinks through to Dan stockpiling goods that night, to the extortion and execution at the drugstore, to their neighbor dying just yards away from them, to the canaries and becoming garbage truck undertakers. Her prose quickly became bullet points, such was her determination to cover every event and every departure from what had, up until recently, been her normal life. "We were attacked on garbage duty. Miles, my boss, came at me with a knife, but Dan saved me. We made it to the evac train. Kim died. We found out by letter. I think the army sterilized me." Events occurred to her out of sequence. The notebook quickly became littered with asterisks leading to separate pages where stub entries could be properly embellished. She paused, the pen hovering above the page, and stared at her own words. "I think the army sterilized me." The permanence of it, were it to be true, began to dawn on her. She flipped the notebook and turned it upside down so that the back cover opened like it was the front page, and she began a new section. "If I die, and this book is found, it's about my life. I'm writing it because I need to. This back part is about my childhood. It's about life before everything went wrong. Although lots of that went wrong anyway, and I'm not sure I'll ever understand why. The front part is about what happened after the satellites failed. If I am never able to have children, I hope at least I can pass on my story." Returning to the front of the notepad, she closed it, exhausted. She'd been writing nonstop for hours. She stretched her hand out several times. The muscles ached from gripping the pen. For all the cramp in her hand, some of the tightness in her chest at least had eased. It was a starting point. She turned to Dan, who had pulled a sleeping mask over his eyes. His head was turned towards the window, and a thin silvery tear trail glistened on his cheek. She looked at him and contemplated his handsome features, the stubble lining his jowl, the tiny furry hairs on the sides of his ears, the creases in the skin across his forehead. She missed him. As the train gradually descended back towards sea level, Colorado's mountainous terrain gave way to fields infused with pale blue reeds. Around mid-afternoon, the train slowed, and a long, curving concrete platform came into view. It was speckled with more of the pale lichen Lucy had seen earlier. Dan stirred at the change of pace and lifted his sleeping mask. Lucy placed her hand on his, relishing the touch of his skin, and the pair looked out at the small group of people waiting on the platform. Two expectant passengers stood side by side awaiting the train, a middle-aged man and woman, both smartly dressed and each with a wheeled suitcase. A lone police officer stood with them, his stern face, which was augmented by a thick handlebar mustache jutting out from beneath a cowboy hat adorned with a sheriff's badge. Here there were no angry crowds, no soldiers, no razor wire, just the prim couple who were now preparing to board one of the A-list carriages further ahead. The train slowed to a crawl but kept moving. The couple began to keep pace with it, realizing it wasn't going to stop. Lucy watched as the cop grabbed the woman's suitcase and threw it into the foremost A-carriage. He shouted instructions to the couple while grabbing the man's bag. The prim woman raised a hand to her abdomen. Lucy wondered if she'd been sterilized, too. She looked too old, surely. A uniformed arm extended out from the carriage door and grabbed the woman's hand, pulling her on board, then reappeared to grab the anxiously jogging man, too. The sheriff hurled the second suitcase on board, then slowed to a walk, watching as the train pulled away, giving a reciprocal salute to the soldier on the train before turning on his heel. Lucy craned her neck as they passed him, watching the cop walk back towards his car, alone. "Excuse me, Luce," said Dan, breaking his vow of silence and edging out from his window seat, heading down the aisle towards the next carriage. When he returned a few minutes later, he said, "I overheard some of the A-listers talking next door. One of them was saying he had evidence that the virus was terrorist in origin, but the other was saying that her lab had eliminated that as a possibility because the samples they'd collected weren't terrestrial." "So?" frowned Lucy. "So I asked them where the bathroom was," said Dan. Ah, so he was still there. He didn't smile, but a flicker of humor was a good sign. "It's two carriages along, by the way," he finished, squeezing back into his seat and setting about unwrapping a Twinkie he'd pulled from his bag. "Ours is out of order. Oh, and that was it. The thing everyone was calling the virus? It's not a virus. Apparently it's more like bacteria or something. Sounded like pro-carrot?" "Prokaryote?" suggested Lucy. Dan tore a chunk out of the Twinkie. "That sounds about right." "Two carriages along, yeah? I'll be back in a minute," said Lucy, setting off up the train. The doors swept aside with a pneumatic hiss. She put her hands out onto the walls ahead to stabilize her transition between carriages as the train rocked. Unlike her own carriage, the first A-list car had much more of a conversational buzz about it. People had gathered in small clusters as best they could, some sitting, others standing around the rows in discussion with each other. Passengers were crossing in and out of the next carriage along with impunity as the porous exchanges continued, so Lucy's entrance broke no unwritten rules. No one gave her so much as a second glance. In the immediate row to her left, a pair slept. To her right, a more industrious pair were engrossed in note-making, one typing furiously on a laptop, the other feverishly annotating some sketches on paper. She was about to continue down the aisle when two individuals entered at the opposite end of the carriage. "Can I have your attention, please, everyone?" declared the foremost new arrival loudly. She was an academic-looking woman of Indian heritage. The woman looked to be in her mid-40s. She wore a smart black cardigan over a plain, light gray top. Her dark hair was center-parted and stopped an inch above her shoulders, framing her tan-colored skin. The man standing next to her was a good decade older, with silvery gray hair that had receded halfway across his pale head. He wore a beige blazer with black dog-tooth patterning and rimless rectangular glasses.
"Apologies for the late running of this briefing," said the woman. "Carriage A7 had a lot of questions, as I'm sure will all of you. My name is Professor Rupali Sheraton. I will be relaying the information we have from NASA. My colleague, Dr. Philip Taro, will then be briefing you on the nature of the pandemic."
The standing occupants of the carriage quickly returned to their seats and pulled out notepads and tablets.
"We can't be exactly sure when this began, but what I'm about to outline took place primarily within a 48-hour period, continued the professor. We believe the satellite failures were caused by a bacterial cloud that was drawn into Earth's gravity. I say bacterial, but really that's by way of analogy. They were single-celled organisms to begin with. Our hypothesis is that the organisms were able to metabolize one of the components of the solar array drive mechanisms in the satellites, resulting in critical failure. While the organisms were proliferating on the satellites, initially undetected, gravity pulled the rest of this transparent cloud into low orbit, where we believe it contaminated an astronaut suit during a spacewalk. The astronaut then unwittingly brought the pathogen aboard the International Space Station, where a crew handover had been going on for several weeks. The organisms interacted with samples in the space station's labs, resulting in new variants. The crew began to notice these anomalous results and reported samples corrupting, overflowing, and generally undergoing rapid change, but they could not identify the cause. The return crew boarded the Soyuz shuttle as scheduled and departed for Earth. While the Soyuz crew were in transit, the remaining astronauts aboard the ISS all experienced fatal cardiac events within minutes of each other. We received no further signal. We then lost contact with the Soyuz capsule, which wasn't discovered until 12 hours later. It had splashed down in the Gulf of Aden, way off course. This was the moment the pathogen transitioned from space to Earth, contaminating our oceans. The Soyuz recovery was probably one of the last things you saw on the news. We took samples from inside the shuttle, which were flown to labs in San Francisco. We never found the crew. It was shortly after the Soyuz was located that the satellites failed completely. First, we lost satellites over China and India, and then over Central Europe, and finally over North America. This pattern is consistent with the hypothesis that the initial contamination came from a gravity-drawn cloud. At this point, I'll hand over to Dr. Taro. The doctor took a half step forward and cleared his throat as Professor Sheraton vacated the spot.
Good afternoon, everyone. As Rupali said, this thing seems to have arrived from space. That's as much as we know in terms of its origins, but it tells us something about its properties. It is an extremophile, for starters, which is going to make it hard to kill. Secondly, it is uniquely aggressive, owing to a number of factors that I'll come to. It is a new domain of life, the fourth domain. Its relationship with DNA is unlike anything observed on Earth. For now, we are simply referring to it as D4.
The balding doctor cleared his throat again and rocked on his heels.
We've tried to sequence its genome and have so far failed. After numerous attempts and after ruling out several other hypotheses, my team and I begin to suspect the presence of non-terrestrial bases in its DNA. That is to say, we suspected our tests were failing because they were encountering something that was not part of the terrestrial GATC set, and therefore something we were not hitherto equipped to measure.
We devised a new test, and I'm pleased, or startled, depending on your perspective, to announce that we have indeed identified two new base pairs. We're not yet certain of their properties or variants, but we consider this definitive proof that the pathogen is extraterrestrial. For now, we're calling the new bases S and Z, in honor of the Soyuz and ISS crews. We believe that D4 has similarities to the CRISPR-Cas9 mechanisms seen in some terrestrial bacteria. It seems able to assimilate the DNA of any species it interacts with and appropriate elements into its own code. Crucially, however, it uses this as a weapon rather than a form of defense. Our most recent findings suggest that the SZ base pairs function as spacers or links between appropriated sets of terrestrial DNA. We believe the SZ bases are the key to its genetic plasticity. What I want to stress to you is that from what we have observed so far, this pathogen has very little in the way of its own identity. D4 is a life form defined not by its manifestations, but by its mechanisms. It is a process, and regarding it as such will be the key to our fight.
The doctor paused, allowing the furious typing and note-making to continue until the audience had caught up.
Our investigations were frustrated by power disruption, he continued, and latterly by loss of key personnel, but we hope to resume the research in Washington. In terms of evidence, my lab took samples from the ocean, the spores that blew inland, and the new fauna that emerged, also from the carcasses of terrestrial mammals that had succumbed to D4, including humans. We have also discovered instances of new species, D4 variants of terrestrial mammals. The vast majority of genetic material in these new species appears to be terrestrial DNA, but those terrestrial sequences are regulated by D4's SZ bases. In essence, D4 scavenges for genetic parts and splices them together. The resulting progeny vary widely in their viability and the extent to which new DNA is expressed. Each new D4 generation remains identifiable through the presence of SZ bases and through their unique reproductive characteristics, despite them exhibiting traits from the organisms they've preyed upon. Reproduction indeed appears to be the key to D4's success, continued the doctor. Regardless of the size or terrestrial genetic composition, it reproduces through fission. Progeny emerge fully matured. We call these occurrences massive respecialization events. In these MREs, the entire pathogen appears to return to a despecialized state, a globule, if you will. This globule then spontaneously re-specializes into one or more fully formed organisms in which appropriated genes are expressed. We believe the MREs have enabled the pathogen to perform evolutionary leapfrogs. 3 weeks ago, this thing was basically a bacterium, and already it's amassed enough cellular material to form organisms millions of times that size. It's evolution at a rate we are not prepared for.
More murmurs from the audience.
However, as it forms increasingly complex organisms, D4's breeding cycle slows, bringing it more in line with what we're used to on Earth. In other words, an SZ bacterium may take minutes, but an SZ sperm whale will take months to gestate, that sort of scale. Hence, the number of SZ-positive mammals we've encountered is vastly smaller than, say, the number of spores you saw in San Francisco. Presumably, availability of food is the greatest rate-limiting factor in its breeding cycle. If it evolves to eat more, faster, it will likely reproduce faster, too, and continue to grow in size. An urgent question for us, then, is how are they consuming enough matter to sustain such growth? We think part of the answer lies in D4's ability to switch from behaving as a single-celled organism to a multicellular one, much like a slime mold. This is possible when D4 takes liquid form, what we've dubbed gen water.
The doctor paused, removing his glasses and cleaning the lenses with the hem of his shirt before replacing them, ignoring a raised hand from the audience.
Gen water is a source both of food and of new genetic material, We believe D4 kills its host, then triggers a rapid digestion process. We don't fully understand the mechanism yet. It could be something akin to an enzyme, or perhaps it utilizes something within the host. We don't know. But what we do know is that once fully digested, the carcass disintegrates and disperses. It does not go straight into an MRE. Each carcass is transformed into gen water. That liquid then disperses and can be co-opted by another D4 organism undergoing an MRE. In our lab, we took two samples. The first was taken from a D4 creature which had looked almost identical to a terrestrial cat before it began to despecialize. It turned to gen water and began to form a globule, a precursor to mass respecialization. We exposed the D4 cat globule to inactive gen water taken from a human cadaver. There was an almost magnetic attraction between the samples. The human gen water was drawn into the cat globule, which grew proportionately to how much we fed it. But the progeny were not half cat, half human, as the ratios would suggest. The globule yielded a dozen smaller creatures, more akin to salamanders. Our interpretation of this is that the D4 cat may have been exposed to salamander DNA during a previous MRE. The genes were stored in its genetic library, dormant until the SZ bases chose to express them in this particular respecialization.
What happened to them then? Asked a woman. To the D4 salamanders.
They attacked each other, replied Dr. Taro. Possibly a consequence of being trapped in a confined space, but we can't be sure at this stage. We terminated the surviving samples.
If D4 can turn into gen water, does that mean the water's alive? Asked a man near the front.
Yes and no, replied the doctor. You could almost think of gen water as stem cells awaiting activation. It's basically an energy-rich DNA soup, which has the ability to become a functional D4 organism. But we don't yet know how or at what point it becomes alive. We also don't understand how D4 is able to transform both organic and inorganic matter into gen water.
Several more hands went up. From what you've said, Dr. Taro, it sounds like the only time they can feed is during reproduction, asked a man near Lucy.
That's the only time we've observed so far, replied the doctor. But that could simply be because we induced it. We have yet to observe feeding in the wild. But I'm sure many of you are already sensing the opportunity this knowledge presents. If we can identify a DNA sequence that is toxic to D4, we could potentially engineer a virus to replicate in the gen water. It could be a way of eradicating the pathogen.
Another hand went up.
Yes, said Professor Sheraton, stepping forward to share the questioning burden.
The gen water process, where the organic host is broken down, is that what happened to the crew of the Soyuz capsule?
Asked a graying woman 3 rows from Lucy.
We believe so, yes, replied the professor. We suspect there is a link between the number of D4 cells and the speed the victim degrades. The Soyuz was an extremely confined space with a heat catalyst. Our hypothesis is that the crew were degraded within the 12 hours it took to locate the capsule, and that their gen water contaminated the ocean. Our fear is that we are now seeing this heat catalyst effect on a global scale. We've lost the contrails from air traffic, and it's pushing average temperatures up.
A dozen hands shot up again, but this time Dr. Taro intervened, raising both of his palms in surrender.
Thank you for your time, everyone. This is the 8th consecutive briefing we've had to do, so perhaps you'll grant us leave for now. We're both situated in carriage A1, so please do come and find us later today if you wish to discuss your thoughts further.
Thank you again.
As the doctor and professor departed, the carriage erupted in conversation. Lucy took half a step forwards, but the man and woman immediately before her had each leaned in from their aisle seats and were engaged in animated discussion. She hesitated.
Can I help you?
Snapped the man, suddenly glaring at her. Sorry, I was... stumbled Lucy.
Don't apologize to him, said the woman, jumping in. Just because our entire understanding of life science has been turned on its head doesn't mean there's not a place for manners. I'm Jean. You are?
She took the woman's proffered hand.
Lucy.
Nice to meet you, Lucy. You're from the carriage behind, I take it?
The woman inquired. The man snorted derisively.
This is Mohammed, continued Jean. As you can probably tell from his social skills, he's a computer scientist.
Don't shun my kind. We're the ones who can get mankind back on track. 90% reduction in population means tiny labor force, means we need automated machines. And automated machines need this guy, he said, pointing to himself with both thumbs. But how about you, Carriage B? What are you for?
Lucy blinked, taken aback. What am I for? She repeated.
That's what I said, isn't it? Snapped the man.
Mo, don't be a jackass, interrupted Jean.
What? We live in a binary world. You're either useful or you're not, he shrugged.
And you're either an asshole or you're not, replied Lucy, regretting her words immediately. Jean laughed.
True, agreed Mohammed, to her surprise. But your carriage could have been filled with medics. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, do shut up, Mo. The whole premise of this train is abhorrent, reproached Jean. It's revolting that we even have to reduce human worth to utility like this. If the new world were populated by the likes of us alone, I'm not sure it's a place I'd want to live.
Are you going past or what? Mohammed snarked, addressing Lucy once again.
Yeah. The bathroom's this way, right, Jean? Asked Lucy.
Yes, dear. Down the stairs at the end, the woman replied.
Lucy nodded and gave her an awkward smile, then headed to the end of the carriage and down the stairs. As she stepped out of the tiny washroom, the train began to slow again. Lucy expected to see another provincial station coming into view alongside the tracks, but there was only a patchwork quilt of forest and fields, turning a hue of dark purple as the sun departed. After a minute of deceleration, the train came to a complete stop, jolting slightly as the brakes locked into position. As Lucy passed back through the A carriage, murmurs spread among the passengers, all craning to see out of their windows.
This must be some mistake, insisted one. We're not supposed to be stopping at all now until DC. That's what they said, right? That's what they said, repeated the woman, looking to her fellow passengers for reassurance.
A soldier hastily ascended the stairs, emerging from the deck below. He hurried through A7, pushing past Lucy and the other folk blocking the aisles. Ignoring their bombardment of questions, he pressed on to the next carriage. Lucy watched him hasten towards the front of the train until misaligned doors obscured him from view. She decided to get back to Dan, politely weaving through the crowded aisles of A7 and A8 until she reached Carriage B. The taboo of silence had been broken by the unexplained stop, and scared B-listers were at last talking to one another openly.
This can't be good, said a lone man, his eyes wrought with fear. I mean, look at what happened in San Francisco, right? First the satellites, then the virus. Now this?
He gestured to the wilderness around them.
I'm sure they'll get us moving again, assured a woman close by softly.
Oh, what do you know? You're stuck here with the rest of us, said the man.
I saw a soldier walking that way, interjected Lucy. I think he's gone to talk to the driver, so I think they're on it. She smiled nervously, realizing all eyes in the carriage were suddenly on her. She hurried away from the threshold to the A-listers and back towards her row, keeping her head down. Dan stood in the aisle next to their seats.
What do you think? Lucy whispered, leaning into him.
No idea,
he whispered back.
But stay close until we're moving again.
Okay, she replied, giving a reassuring grin to a nervous-looking child a few rows ahead, who quickly looked away. Lucy returned to her seat and scoured the twilight for clues. After 15 minutes, the intercom crackled into life.
Attention all passengers, this is Lieutenant Gladwell. We have been advised by HQ to discontinue our journey to DC. We have received information that the Capitol has been compromised and that we are to await further instructions. We will bring you more information when we have it, but for now we'll be staying right here.
The intercom mic clicked off, giving way to an upswell of voices demanding answers and proclaiming conclusions. As the bickering continued, the last of the daylight faded behind the mountains, and night moved in on their position.
"We're in the wrong carriage for information," said Dan, casting his eyes around at the scared-looking B-listers. "Someone in the other coaches will know the real reason we've stopped. They must, otherwise they wouldn't be on board."
At that moment, the compartment door hissed open and the lieutenant entered, flanked by two other soldiers.
"What do you think it means?"
the lieutenant snarled in response to an anxious passenger. The soldiers hastened through the carriage and down to the deck below without a word, brushing aside those who got in their way. Lucy tiptoed over to the stairwell and tried in vain to catch some of the hushed conversation. The only noise to reach her was the clicking of weapons being loaded. The two soldiers who had flanked the lieutenant reappeared, now fully clad in combat uniforms. Helmets and flak jackets on, and assault rifles in hand, they made their way back through the aisle and into the next carriage, their guise and weaponry preemptively clearing their path. Lucy retook her seat next to Dan, who was facing the window. She studied his reflection in the glass of their cocoon, watching as his eyes tracked from side to side, trying to follow his gaze. A commotion in the adjoining carriage pricked Lucy's ears. The doors hissed open, and a terrified, bedraggled elderly man stumbled forwards. Gripping the geriatric by the scuff of his suit, a stronger man of around 40 coerced his ward forwards. Without thinking, Lucy stepped out into the aisle, blocking the pair's way.
"Who are you, and what are you doing with him?"
she asked, directly challenging the strong man.
"Lucy!"
hissed Dan, rising from his seat.
"I'm saving our lives, is what I'm doing!"
the man shouted back, his biceps showing through his navy blue checkered shirt, a dark brown beard embellishing his round face.
"Now move!"
he cried, jostling the old man forward again. Lucy edged back a few paces.
"Luce!"
Dan pleaded. She ignored him. With a heavy sigh, Dan addressed the bearded man.
"Just tell us what you're doing with him,"
Dan stated, approaching the edge of their row.
"Jesus fucking Christ, you people aren't even supposed to be on this train,"
cried the assailant.
"What is going on?"
growled the lieutenant as his heavy footsteps echoed up the stairs. The old man mumbled incoherently, sobbing as he hung from his adversary's grip, the soles of his feet barely touching the floor.
"He's bleeding," yelled the bearded man to the lieutenant. "You know what we have to do, sir,"
he added, lowering his voice.
"Please, please, it'll pass. I know it will,"
spluttered the old man, reaching again for his handkerchief as a hacking cough took hold. When he pulled the handkerchief away, the white cotton was speckled with blood.
"Oh my God, put him down! He needs help!" cried Lucy, aghast. "He needs to get the hell off this train is what he needs," replied the bearded aggressor. "You know what's coming for us if we don't," stated the man, addressing the lieutenant.
The lieutenant said nothing for a moment. With his eyes cast downwards, he gave the smallest of nods.
"Come on then," said the vigilante, shoving the old man forwards.
Lucy and Dan parted, stunned by the lieutenant's endorsement of the situation. The lieutenant followed the two men down below. Lucy mustered her senses and rushed after them.
"You can't be serious," she protested. "You're not actually gonna leave him out there alone. He'll freeze to death if nothing else." "Quiet, ma'am. You don't know what's at stake here," cried the bearded man over his shoulder. There was a flash of fear in his eyes. "I'm doing this for all of us," he insisted through gritted teeth.
His voice wavered ever so slightly as the rear carriage door loomed close.
"There must be another way, something we can do," pleaded Lucy, stalling for time. "We need to talk about this first, rationally."
She slipped around the lieutenant and appeared at the bearded man's side, placing a hand on his arm as he reached the back of the train. The lieutenant intervened, wrenching Lucy's hand away. The bearded man relinquished his ward.
Please,
stammered the old man, facing his captor. He spluttered again, showering his shirt and shoes with blood. A small number of flecks landed on the bearded man's boots.
"Ugh!"
cried the bearded man in horror, kicking the emergency exit door wide open. Cold air rushed in.
"Go!"
he urged the old man, pointing to the black outside. The whimpering geriatric shuffled half a pace towards the open doorway and turned to face his jury, imploringly.
"Go!"
roared the aggressor, this time spinning the elderly martyr back around and shoving him out of the train.
The old man fell downward onto the tracks with a cry, landing heavily upon the sharp stones and timber beams. One shaky limb at a time, the splayed victim raised himself back onto all fours, a shuddering mess of weeping, coughing, and spluttering. He swayed precariously, staggering back to his feet, turning to face the vessel from which he'd been ejected. The strong, bearded assailant finished hastily mopping up every last drop of blood from both the carriage floor and his shoes. He chucked the speckled tissues out towards the old man, where a gust of wind snatched them off into the darkness. The venerable victim looked up at his executioners, clasping his trembling hands together as he shuffled back towards them. The bearded man leaned out and grabbed the emergency door, slamming it shut again. His brow was knitted and his thick eyebrows converged downward on the bridge of his nose. The mustache covering his lip twitched as he stared out at the old man. The lieutenant peeled away from the window, cursing. Dan took his stead, filling the vacant space next to Lucy and the bearded man. Light spilled out from both decks, partially illuminating the wild grass and ferns swaying on either side of the rails. Lucy's attention shifted to the lieutenant's voice behind them as he spoke to the train driver via the guard's private intercom.
100 yards won't be enough,
interrupted the strong man, approaching the lieutenant.
Tell him we need to move at least a mile forwards if we're going to be safe.
The lieutenant revised his order to the driver. With a creaking lurch, the train began to edge forwards. Lucy turned back to the window and watched as the old man fell away into the darkness. His outstretched hand vanished, replaced by desolate stretches of track. Something struck the right side of the carriage with a bang. Then another bang, this time from the roof, prompting screams from the top deck. The train plunged to a higher speed, throwing Lucy and Dan off balance. The lieutenant rushed upstairs, grabbing an assault rifle as he went, closely marked by the bearded man. Dan and Lucy followed.
"Turn off all the lights," shouted the lieutenant. "Now!"
The terrified passenger sprang into action and extinguished the reading lights. Only the dim LEDs lining the aisle remained lit. The passengers' reflections in the windows vanished, and Lucy's eyes began to adjust to the darkness outside. Glimpses of moonlit branches flickered in and out of the window view as the train continued to accelerate. The train clattered over the tracks, loudly jostling in every direction.
"There! Out there!"
cried a passenger, pointing into the darkness. As the occupants huddled to see, a second clang resonated across the roof. Lucy spun around. With a third clang, the carriage ceiling buckled inwards in the shape of a great fist. The lieutenant leapt under the metal depression and fired 3 rounds directly into the roof. The passengers screamed in shock, deafened by the blast and belatedly covering their ringing ears. The carriage jolted again, sending the lieutenant off balance as the train hurtled forward at full tilt. Lucy pressed her face to the glass and stared downward. Odd shapes flickered in and out of the lower deck's lighting spill, blending with the night. Lucy's heart skipped a beat as 2 dark limbs raced forwards alongside the track in great strides, only to vanish as quickly as they appeared. 2 more pangs struck the carriage, this time at the rear of the top deck. With a great wrenching sound, the emergency exit disappeared, ripped from its hinges entirely. At that moment, the entire world spun. Lucy was thrown into the air as the carriage revolved beneath her. The emergency lighting immediately cut out, plunging her into total darkness as the train rolled, throwing its occupants around like a blender. Time went into slow motion as Lucy tumbled helplessly through the darkness, immersed in the screams of her fellow passengers. She ricocheted off seats, luggage racks, and bodies as the momentum flung her down the carriage. In her last seconds of consciousness, she registered the cold, rushing air as it hit her face.